This is another iRaw podcast.
The fact that they're living and they're a living being doesn't make them any different than any other chattel.
In this episode, Angela Fernandez joins me to discuss animals and the legal notion of first possession. Angela is a professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of Toronto and is cross-appointed to the Department of History. She is the author of Pearson vs. Post, The Hunt for the Fox, Law and Professionalization in American Legal Culture, which is often used when discussing property law in the US and Canada. Angela is also an associate editor for Law and History Review, is on the board of directors for Animal Justice Canada, is a fellow at the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics, as well as a member for Brooks Animal Studies Academic Network. So this is recording now, so fingers crossed that everything works well. So thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast. As you know, it's a new endeavor, and we're testing things out. So thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. I'm very happy to do it.
Great. Could you possibly at the beginning now maybe just tell us a little bit about you and how you came to be interested in animals?
Yeah, so my interest in animals, it's about, I don't know, maybe about 5 or 6 years. I started to work on a famous animal case in property law called Pearson and Post, mm-hmm. which is about a hunted fox. And I started to look at this from the point of view of as a legal historian, because I'm a legal historian, and it didn't really dawn on me for many years, actually, I have to confess, working on this case, that there was really something there that was particular about the hunting of the animal. Mm-hmm. And then once I did come to notice it, it started to bother me more and more.
So and you were just seeing it as
It was just a case, and okay. It was sort of like a canonical, sort of important, what we call a leading case. Mm-hmm. It's often used to introduce students to the concept of first possession, or just possession generally, because what's happening in the case is there's a guy, his name's Post, he's chasing a fox on a beach. A second individual named Pearson intervenes and takes the fox, and they fight, it's mine. And the case, goes up to the New York Supreme Court, and it ends up, the judges and the lawyers at that level end up producing this very elaborate report on first possession of a wild animal.
So this is in the U.S.?
This is in the U.S. It's in New York. The scuffle happens in 1802, and the reported judgment is 1805. Yeah, so quite some time ago, yeah. And what happened is, because the report is quite elaborate, there's a majority decision written by one of the judges that says, well, really, you haven't captured an animal because you've really captured it. Because it could always get away. And so that intervener...
Until you hold it, and
probably killed it. But until you really got it and it can't escape. Mm-hmm. Whereas the dissent says, no, there's this other rule in the authorities. You know, there's a lot of old authorities on this question. And there's a lot of authority on this contrary rule, which is called a hot pursuit rule, which is you're chasing it, you've declared your intention to take it, and other people should respect that. They should... You know,
so because you've shown intent that you want it, it's yours.
That's the idea, or at least people should give you the chance to complete and see if you can get it. And if it gets far away from you, well, then maybe it's free game again, you know?
Okay.
But it sort of connects to this idea that we'll look at in a little bit, the fast fish, loose fish, because for whales, there was a sort of a similar kind of an idea that if you're held on fast to the whale, then it's yours. But if it gets loose from you and gets let go, that's called loose fish, then anybody can take it.
So do you only have one chance to get... So,
right, how many? Yeah,
so if you're in pursuit, it's really odd, because if you're in pursuit, then it means that you've got one chance, and if you capture it and you hold it, then it goes, then
you do you have another chance? Or
yes, you can could. You could retake. Yeah, you know, you could try to retake, just like anybody else could come along and retake. But you know what's very. I mean, it took me a very long time to kind of appreciate this. But what's sort of important, I think, to see. You know, what I'm trying to get people to think about the case and to teach it maybe with this a bit more in mind is that both of these roles, either the capture role or the hot pursuit role, they're really presupposing that the animal is property.
Yeah.
And that, you know, one of these two is going to kill it, own it, kill it, whatever, whichever order. And, you know, nobody is really considering the possibility like, hey, this is a wild animal. Maybe the wild animal owns itself in the same way that you and I own itself. And it's not subject to this as between the two competitors. But the case, it's always framed like that, as between the two competitors. And, you know, in law school...
So there isn't even a third contender there's
no,
in this?
No, exactly. Mm. And you know, because it's a famous case, and I do this type of history, legal history, called legal archaeology, where you look at a famous leading case and then you try to dig around the facts and circumstances and find out about the litigants and the lawyers and where it happened.
So is this kind of like a
social kind of social history in a way?
When you say archaeology, this makes me think of Foucault. So is it like...
It's a little bit like that, or it's actually more like almost more literal in the sense of like digging, like you're digging basically, and you know, in different archives and tax records and genealogical records and just kind of trying to piece together like what's the story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what we end up getting in a law report is really just the very tip of the iceberg. There's this whole...
Well, what led to that decision, right?
Exactly. And what will often happen is that, you know, it'll get translated so much through the legal process that it'll become almost unrecognizable to the original parties by the time it actually gets up to a sort of an appeal level.
So you're almost looking predating the... So, like, did Pearson and Post have something between them before?
Exactly. Before the case even came about? Asking about, like, the families and then what was what. And it looks like with Pearson and Post, that what the situation was is that beach where the fox was chased, it's contiguous to a lot of Pearson land. And Pearson, they were an old, wealthy family, and they would have not liked fox hunting coming to their area because they're farmers, and they're like, oh my God, if English-style fox hunting comes, there's going to be horses knocking down fences. So they were probably trying to kind of send a message to Post, who came from a slightly different part of town, also an old, wealthy family, but different form of wealth. Mm-hmm. His father was more mercantile wealth, and he's kind of putting on airs, you know, doing this... like sort of, you know, English style fox hunt. Well, there's no horses, but you know, he was
like
out.
A chase,
exactly. So kind of trying to give him the message like, it's not welcome here. But then, you know, so Pearson,
they were trying to use the legal system as a way to actually fight a much bigger political battle.
I think they were just, they were like, and in a way it's sort of like what, you know, what we think of as legal process, like what is it for? It's to make sure people don't actually like take to punching each other.
Yeah.
Right. Like they agree, okay, we'll submit it to somebody else to decide. And so in this case, they went to, Post went to, the local magistrate, and it's likely he did that because his father was a magistrate. So he kind of knows like, okay. And his dad might've even said like, okay, go and get this resolved. They held, a jury trial. So there was, you know, community of neighbors who basically listened to things. And then what they determined was that Post would win. So they're saying, yes, you know, you were going after the fox and people should have, you know, Pearson shouldn't have just swooped in and clubbed it. But we're only going to give
Pearson
you...
clubbed it.
Well, that's what we think.
Okay.
We don't know for sure. And sometimes people say that he was shot, but the only thing I was able to find about, you know, saying how the fox died was as an older story about how it was clubbed with a piece of a fence railing.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So...
Okay. Sorry, I derailed
no,
you.
No. That's okay. But so Post does win at the jury trial, but he's only given 75 cents. And so,
how much does that translate to?
Even in 1802, this is not very much.
Okay.
Like, it's about as much as it would cost to have one of the witnesses appearing or, you know, like... And the costs for the trial were $5, which, you know, is a little bit more that Pearson would have had to pay, so $5.75. But his appeal to the New York Supreme Court, you just think, really? You're going to appeal a $5.75 decision? That seems like a little bit. But, you know, he contacts... he has a cousin who is a fancy lawyer who, I guess, you know, he talked to about it, and he's probably kind of excited that, oh my gosh, well, I would love to take this to the New York Supreme Court because you know, there are all these old authorities, civil law, natural law authorities on how do you acquire possession in a wild animal, like Justinian's Institutes and Pufendorf and Barbariac and all these, like, you know, these, like, philosophers that we know a little bit about, but, you know, we don't really, you know, read those texts the same way anymore, at least not in law. And
I like the name Pufendorf. That's a good name. I haven't heard it before, actually, but it just makes me think of Harry Potter. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. So Pearson was the one chasing. Was that the Post was chasing?
Yeah, Post is the original
Post
chaser.
Post was chasing. Pearson was the one who we think clubbed the fox and took it. They went to court and Post won.
Yes, at the first level, Post wins.
And then his cousin was involved in the legal
system. And then the guy who loses, Pearson, his cousin, Nathan Sanford, is sort of, we think, probably saying, oh, okay, sure, I'll do this for you. And then it gets appealed to the New York Supreme Court, where it does get reversed.
Oh.
And at that point, it takes over 2.5 years for this to happen. And the cost by this time amount to about almost $130.
Oh, my goodness.
Which at that time is quite a lot of money. And so, and what I do in my book on the case is I sort of tie this to what's happening with the professionalization of law generally in early 19th century New York. So lawyers like that lawyer, Nathan Sanford, are sort of starting to figure out, oh, hey, there's actually like a pretty nice little niche business in taking on these appeals from lower level justices of the peace, because they're not legally trained. So in the proceedings, they'll make little mistakes sometimes. And so they try to peel on those mistakes.
Oh.
And there's a very good chance.
It's very shrewd.
And there's a very good chance that an upper court will reverse, because they'll say, well, yeah, you made mistakes. There were mistakes made.
Interesting.
And that actually does kind of take off and become a big business by about 1815, 1816. There's lots of these cases. But in 1805, when I looked, I had looked in about 900 of judgment rolls, and I could only find, I think there was like nine of them, and maybe seven of them were reversed. So it's kind of like, if you're doing a calculation, you think, oh yeah, I'm gonna appeal it. I'm gonna try and get it reversed, and that's that's a good strategy.
It seems like a foolproof,
exactly,
almost foolproof way to do it.
And the costs are not capped. Later on, a couple of years later, the legislature passes an act to say, look, this $130 for a 75-cent award. This gross disproportion. Your costs can't actually exceed, they say, $25, because the statute under which it happens is called the $25 Act. It's basically like a small claims court, like what we would call a small. So you can only ask for a much.
So now
as
it's
much
gone. It's become bigger than what the original court was prepared to deal with.
Yeah, and that's really like the idea behind like the professionalization idea, is that like the lawyers and the judges are getting hold of this and basically blowing it way up out of proportion.
Okay.
That was a neighborhood scuffle that, you know, the community had sort of said, yeah, you should have something for that post. You should get a nominal 75 cents, but, you know, this is not a big deal. And, you know, then the lawyers get involved and they...
So why did they make it such a big deal?
Well, you know, it's hard to say, like, for sure, but I think it was just... like, this is an interesting opportunity to make some arguments before the New York Supreme Court using these authorities that they would have been trained in and would have known. And that's kind of an interesting dimension of this whole thing, because there's not really law schools at the time. So what lawyers are doing is they are going and apprenticing themselves in the offices of senior lawyers.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe their dad would pay like some money for them to be able to do that. And then in exchange, that senior lawyer was supposed to mentor them and give them access to their books. And if they were lucky, maybe, you know, they would talk to you once a week and ask you some questions about what you're reading. And those books that were assigned were often these old civil law, natural law, and a lot of times related to maritime law books, like Justinian's Institutes and Pufendorf and these fellows. And so they knew those texts.
For people that don't know, mm-hmm. So what are these texts? Like, so are these lawyers, or are these people thinking about law?
So they are like scholars. They're really philosophers.
Okay.
So Justinian was the emperor of Rome who got people to collate all the law together for him. So that's sort of an older text. Yeah, Justinian. Mm-hmm. And then in the 17th and in the 18th century, there's a lot of, they're really philosophers. Like if we read them now, we would read those texts and they would read like a philosophy text where they're saying, you know, according to the natural law, what would we say about, you know, for instance, well, one of the big areas they talked a lot about that Americans were interested in was marine insurance. That they would talk about, like, what would happen at sea if there was a dispute, let's say. And why do they care about that so much? Well, because all those nations, like France and England and Spain, and they are all shipping and trading with one another.
Yeah, this is the high time.
This is the height. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's really, so people, like, we look at those sources sometimes and we think, oh, that's very esoteric and that's kind of just... You know, they're just off doing that. There's no law school, so they have to be doing something, so they're reading this text. But those texts actually were really relevant to litigation that they could get.
This is literally a time in which people are trying to figure out what is their legal relationship with animals.
I think that the animal aspect of it is very underdeveloped for them. I don't think that this, for them, I think for them the significance of the animal was really its insignificance.
Okay.
Like, this happened to be about an animal. But, you know, I mean, it is true that first possession and possession in a wild animal was one of these classic questions that was addressed in a book like the Institutes. And so in that sense, it's important that it's an animal. Mm-hmm. But what's important about it is not its status as animal, but more its what people call, now we call it, its status as a fugitive resource.
Fugitive resource?
Yeah, which basically means it's something that moves. So in property, we don't do this, hold this distinction as much in common law, but in civil law property, we say, well, there's a big distinction between movable property and immovable property. And immovable property is like real estate in the common law, you know, like stuff that doesn't move.
Yes.
And then movable property is more like chattel, what we call chattels in common law. And people are interested in property that moves because they're wondering, well, how do I establish that I'm the owner of that? Because what if it moves away, often moves away from me?
So this is really interesting because chattel, obviously, I would be curious to know how chattel is used in legal parlance versus everyday talk of chattel. Because mm-hmm. when you say chattel, it immediately, I have two immediate reactions to it. One makes me think of slaves.
Yes, chattel slavery, absolutely.
And
yes.
The second, it makes me think of cows and cattle because mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. their I can never say this word.
Etymological. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're connected.
Yeah.
So I guess in that way, you know, at one point in history, slaves were considered movable property.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's super relevant. And one of the things that I found out doing this research on Pearson and that I write about a bit in the book is just that there's actually a lot of slave owning on Long Island at this time,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, coming to it, I was sort of surprised to find that because I thought, oh, well, I'm in the North and I don't know. I just didn't think I'm in the countryside. I'm not in New York City. So I thought, look, this is kind of weird, but there's a lot of slave owning. And in fact, a lot of the litigants, and not the litigants, the participants in this, like the justice of the peace, the parties, the guy who owns the house where the trial takes place, they're pretty much all slave owners.
So that's very interesting in terms of thinking of how, did that feature into your analysis in terms
yes.
of thinking?
It featured into it indirectly in the sense that I thought that the aspect of the social history where I'm describing the you know, what's on the ground, that should be there. And
yes.
people should know that. And so, for instance, when I went back to Southampton last spring to talk about the book and to meet with some of the historians who helped me work on it about a decade ago was when I first
wow.
went there to do the research. And just to show them, like, oh, here it is. And, you know, thank you so much for helping me. But, you know, in a crowd like that, I really feel like it's very important to emphasize the slavery because I think it's not something that people are talking about a whole lot.
Well, in thinking about animals and the idea of first possession, and, you know, even in my interview with both Will and Leslie now, what came up is that property and the property status of animals is the current, at least for them, the linchpin of where
mm-hmm.
a lot of
mm-hmm.
issues surrounding how animals are treated.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, could be started and potentially where it should, you know, these conversations should be focused.
Yeah.
But then, and maybe we should speak about the significance of this case in a bit, because first possession then seems, like you said, to have very little to do with the fox, but maybe in this context of slave ownership has once again to do with trying to assert, again, a certain ideal of what it means to be human, what it means to be in control.
Yeah, to assert your right to occupy. Really, you know, I mean, you know, first possession, it's the word that gets used in the case is manucaption, which is this like man, like your hands, like man in French,
yeah.
Like manucaption or occupation. And the idea, and it's all about like how much do you have to do to be considered the most of a successful occupant of two rival occupants. So you think, oh, like France and Spain or, you know, like, I mean, you know, this because this is a time when people are operating as if, yeah, you can occupy, and that is just, that's your natural right. You know, these philosophers, they're all talking about it in terms of it's our natural right to travel the globe and to do these things.
So first possession is really, it comes in so many ways in terms of thinking about, I guess, our history, right? A lot of people would talk about colonial histories. I'm from South Africa, and I know that colonial histories, you know, living in Canada now, they come up constantly, you know, who has claim to something.
Absolutely.
Somehow always ends up coming back to a conversation about who was here first.
Right. And who captured, who held it, you know, and who was able to keep a hold of it. And, you know, there's all this, you know, violence, right? It's rife with violence. And what's so interesting, I think, about Pearson is that it's got all of that packed into it. But yet, when you read it, and when you're talking about it in a class with students, for instance, because it has this humorous descent that's very witty and very, and everyone's sort of feeling like, oh, the animal's kind of insignificant, not really important here, and there's like a lot of, you know, it's like a jokey. I think the reason people love the case is because it has that dimension to it.
What is a descent?
A descent is basically where you've got like one of the judges, maybe or maybe more, saying we don't agree with the rule that the rest have adopted. So the majority rule in that case was the capture rule.
I see. So
and then the dissent is saying, I disagree.
Okay.
I think it should be, and here, it's Brockles Livingston.
So now the majority rule was saying that Pearson was correct.
Exactly. Yeah. The most successful occupier, the person who seized and held.
So Pearson, the person who held onto the fox, is the most important. Like they're the winner, in essence,
yes,
the owner,
yes.
The property holder, but now this dissent is disagreeing, but it seems as though it's being done in a jovial kind of way, so it's not really serious.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing, is that it's being done in this way where you're not, you know, like, is he serious or is he not, you know? Mm. And you know, because I worked on this for so long, I struggled with this for quite, you know, trying to figure out, like, what do I say about this? Because on the one hand, that hot pursuit rule is a serious rule. You know, there's all as good an authority supporting it as there is supporting the capture rule. But did Livingston really mean it to be the rule here? I don't know. I don't know. In a way, did he really even care? I think he's just trying to play the devil's advocate a little bit, and he's trying to...
Is Livingston the judge?
Livingston's the judge. Dissent. Yeah, he's the dissenting judge. Yeah, he's the dissenting judge, and I think he is, in a way, trying to say, look, like, why is this thing blown up so much? But instead of saying, well, why is this thing blown up so much, and criticizing the lawyers and his colleague writing the majority, he kind of, like, ramps it up. You know, and he makes it even more elaborate.
He's using hyperbole to just show the ridiculousness of it all.
Exactly. And it kind of fits into a literary tradition that's developing at the time. It's kind of a Rabelaisian type of humor where you're writing and reversing things on its head and this kind of thing.
Okay.
And it turns out I have a chapter about this in the book, but Washington Irving actually clerked in worked in Livingston's office. And so if you read the dissent and kind of compare it to that trend of literature that's being produced, it's very similar.
Because this is something Leslie and I were chatting about a little bit, where we were saying, you know, she was explaining to me a bit about how common law works and that you are kind of building on, and there are these tensions between building on. But I think where your work is really interesting is dialing it back and considering the historical context. You start to, you start to get a sense of sometimes it's not really the law. I mean, the law is definitely there, but there are these other social factors such as who's your living mates and who's your cousin. And
absolutely, and, absolutely. Ideas pertaining and that to. This happened to be a kind of an old chestnut question that these judges and lawyers kind of got excited about, and then they were willing to take it up. And then what you needed to have for this was not just them getting excited at the time, but you also needed, like, later on treatise writers to notice it and then to include it in their books, you know? Oh. And then eventually, starting about 1900, people are noticing it in those books, and then they're going to put it in case books, which are basically the anthologies that get used in law school classrooms.
Okay. So those are how precedents get set?
Well, precedents would get set in just by the court issuing the judgments.
Okay.
And so lawyers would be like, oh, okay, I got to know, like, the cases on this topic to know, like, where the common law has developed and what kind of arguments are available to me to make.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just get those from, you know, a database or... But for law school instruction, what we do is we kind of pick, like, examples that we think are particularly illustrative.
Yes.
And not even necessarily from the same jurisdiction, like from jurisdictions all over. And we put them together in books where they're excerpted.
So these are the anthologies,
and these are the anthologies. Okay. And so it's a little bit like the Norton Anthology of American Literature or something like that. Like, you're kind of deciding, okay, we're going to canonize these particular cases. And so you know, this, it was sort of different people around about the same time sort of came to the consensus that Pearson should be one of these cases. And so they put it, like, you know, on the first page of the property case book. And then what happens then is then, okay, it gets taught to all of these people. And then generation after generation gets taught to, you know, more and more people.
Are there other cases of animals in this
property, you know, book? It's interesting. Now that animal law will have its own case books now also.
Okay.
So those are, you know, well, it's the same thing. They'll be like leading cases on, you know, for animal law. But the common law cases that have to do with animals, they get included in all sorts of different domains and areas. Okay. And I think it's because they do often tend to be kind of appealing because often they're, like, slightly humorous, you know, like it'll be, there'll be a cow in a contracts case. And everybody will kind of remember, oh yeah, like, look, I used to teach this contracts. I teach contracts also, and I had this cow case. And, you know, I had a student on a test once, and she couldn't remember the name of the case, but she just wrote the cow case, you know. And it's because I think the animal cases, they have these kind of vivid facts, and people tend to remember them.
Well, I think also potentially because people see the beings of, like, you can relate somehow.
You can relate a little bit more.
A cow and a fox are more relatable. You can, even when you speak about Pearson and Post, you can actually visualize a fox running down a beach and someone running after them, and you can, it becomes,
it's more of a story. And a story in a way, you know, which I think is always, like, appealing to us, and it's easier for us to.
But there is something devastating in the jovial nature with which they're dealt with as well.
I think
something you pointed to at the beginning, that there are two people contending for property, and there is property in quotes, because there's no consideration of, you know, the fox as being a being or the cow as having any sort of claim to
Any themselves. Interests or it's sort of like we're acting like, well, the fact that they're living and they're a living being doesn't make them any different than any other chattel.
I really do think there's an interesting connection here, though, in terms of thinking, like, chattel, again, it just brings up all of this type of imagery, because there is a continuation, and I think showing how certain people have historically been, you know, considered property, and that there is actually precedent for property status to be overturned. I don't know if that's the right way to
absolutely
phrase it.
Absolutely. And I wonder if when you were talking to Leslie, she mentioned this quote from Wendy Adams, this idea that, you know, okay, with property, like, we made non-human animals property, and did we do that, you know, really because we wanted to use them?
Mm.
You know, that our desire to treat them as property kind of, you know, is sort of what came first.
Did we make them... we didn't make them property. No, we made them property so that we can use
them. That we can use them. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so what I sometimes think when people really focus on, well, let's try to get the legal status changed and get them not to be not property anymore, is that if we still have that need to use them and then we still have the social consensus that we're going to use them, the property status itself is maybe not as, you know, it's not going to be like a magic wand and you wave it and then now we're going to be treating non-human animals with respect and dignity. It's sort of like, yeah, we've, you know, and law is often very light. That is very instrumental. It's sort of a, we project onto it what we want it to do and then we use it to, you know. So people will say, for instance, well, why can't we make non-human animals legal persons? We make corporations legal persons. We you know, you can make a river a legal person, a municipality or a ship or... And the idea there is, well, we could do that because we can kind of do whatever we want.
Mm.
But, you know, people had no problem making corporations legal persons because that made it more useful to, you know, use them to say, okay, there's a separation between, you know, personal liability. You can say, well, now it's the entity that's liable and there's a veil there that you can't pierce. And there are all sorts of useful reasons for doing that. And the problem with non-human animals is the use is going the exact opposite way.
Yeah, so who's interested in protecting?
And one who's going to be motivated to do that. And lots of people are more and more, I think. But animal use industries obviously are not. And so they get, you know, they're very, very, get very, very nervous whenever anyone starts to question the property status.
So how does the property status first, like, what in Canada, like Canada law, like how did this property status,
like, where is it actually established and set out? You know, it's so interesting because I sort of feel like, I mean, I should try to do more research on this and see, but it's almost, to me, it feels like something that is just sort of presupposed.
Okay.
Like it's just like it seems like it would be, it seems like it's obvious. And, you know, and where does that come from? Well, you know, I think meat eating is a large part of it, right? It's because we want to do that. And so you can't think of them as being entities with interests if you're going to do that. Or, you know, we want them as companions. And so then we want them to be our property. So then, you know, we have say over
what's what with them. It's interesting that you say that, because I also think many people who have companion animals, dogs or cats, probably wouldn't use the
They
words.
Would not, absolutely, absolutely.
It comes up in the way we speak, right? This is my dog. Although, I mean, you might say the same thing about your child. This is my son. I think maybe that's a failure of the English language.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially just showing how possession itself is so,
yes,
I think, central to, certainly in English, it's almost hard to say some sentences without laying claim to some sort of hierarchy or first possession.
Yes. And we were like that about children, right? They were, you know, historically, like, they were little mini workers, you know, and that was like my little mini worker, you know. So
relationships have all changed.
And they've all changed so much.
And coming back to talking about first possession as a concept, what do you think? Do you think that this should be played with in law now? Like, how? What are the implications of this Pearson and Post decision in terms of first possession? And what should we be doing about it now?
Yes. Well, I mean, I do think that there's a lot of reverberations from Pearson and the capture rule and first possession generally. I mean, in terms of those issues we were talking about with, you know, to think about it in terms of colonization and occupation and all of that really should be very front and center.
Yeah.
But there's also, you know, issues relating to the way that the capture rule is used in other contexts of other fugitive resources. So for oil and gas and for groundwater and other things that move, and you want to, you know, at least arguably reward the person who puts the labor into kind of getting it. But the problem with the capture rule in an environmental context is that it really incentivizes people to take more than they can use, and a lot will spill and waste. And so it's a very antisocial, very anti-environmental rule. And so I think that's something that is acknowledged, but, you know, then we kind of say, well, we acknowledge it. And then, for instance, you know, in Texas, where this was actually a problem with oil and gas wells, they were like, well, we can't use the common law. We can't use Pearson because, you know, we'll end up wasting so much of our resource. So legislatures have had to legislate around the common law rule. And so just as a rule, it's not a great rule, really. And so, you know, when I came to it, I was sort of surprised.
That's the rule of capture?
The rule of capture, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of surprised that most legal scholars tend to present it as if it is a good rule. It's an efficient rule. It's a bright line rule.
Is it the common rule? It's the common rule.
It's the common law practice. Yeah, it's supposed to be the common law rule. So that would be the default rule unless the legislature has passed something to the contrary.
Okay.
And then if there's a statute, then the statute could change the common law for sure.
Interesting. I think you've touched on so many important things there, though, in terms of environmental change and our relationships with animals. You know, at the center of a lot of that is the idea that it's ours to possess. And also, like, terra nullius,
yes.
You know, the whole idea that I'm here first, therefore it's mine. And even, you know, not just first, but you said control of. And I, you know, in a lot of the historical documents, you start to realize that people that were coming to the U.S. and colonies, it wasn't just a matter of they had arrived. What they saw themselves as being superior was that they were also farmers, that they had somehow an ability to manipulate and control the land, and therefore they were superior to, you know, in quotation marks, superior to and better than anyone else that was here. And for the first time ever, I'm seeing how this was being justified by using this idea of I mean, this probably predates those laws, but you can see how that thinking is being, I guess,
used operationalized and,
you know, bubbling there. There's a word. I'm sitting there, like, I'm trying to think. It's not fermenting. It's coming. Oh, anyway, doesn't matter.
Percolating.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Why did that like suddenly come out to me? Yes.
But certainly, I think these ideas of when first was no longer good enough to say, well, first and control. And I think.
Yeah, because other people were there first. But it's the first, and then you have the legal arguments to say, well, this is why it should be ours, you know, and that's sort of another thing, right? But at the time, this would be considered very, very important, right? It's very important because people are realizing, oh, you know, like in the case of Long Island, you know, there are native tribes, they're there. You know, the Shinnecock are there. And so, you know, it's so interesting because in one of the things about the Pearson decision is that they describe in the facts the beach, they call it wasteland. And they say, you know, you picture this fox running on this land that, like, nobody cares about. You know, it's like Lockean waste. It's no good for farming. And so it's just no good for anything. And then you think, what? No, that beach was, like, super valuable. Like, it's giving access to the sea and to oysters and to fish and to seaweed and to whales and to, you know, seagrass and all these things that people are using. And it's not just the European settlers are using it. The Shinnecock are using it. And obviously the animals are all using it. And, you know, this is very valuable, you know. And then, of course, as it turns out, this part of Southampton just got, like, the most expensive real estate in the United States now, you know. So when you're there, you're like, wow, they really call this wasteland. That's kind of amazing. Because, you know, it's like it's very,
top
very valuable now, right?
Ideas change.
Yes, absolutely.
So what do you see as history's role in thinking about law and animals? What is history's role to play here?
Yeah, I think this is very important because generally I think history, and especially legal history, it's really important because it helps you see how these things that kind of come down to you as received wisdom. So, you know, a chestnut leading case, capture rule, best rule, that's what everybody says, end of story, let's go home. You know, once you start looking into it, you start to realize, oh, actually, this is a lot more complicated. There's another side to this story. Mm. This didn't inevitably happen. There were people who decided that, you know, this decision should go into casebooks, or there were people who decided that this was a good philosophy to promulgate. Mm. There were people who decided to take this case and appeal it up. And so, you know, there are all these human decisions that are happening at all these different junctures that are otherwise kind of rendered invisible. And then the whole thing looks very inevitable. And if it's something negative and bad, then you think, oh my God, that inevitable thing was just, you know, that was just going to happen. We were going to get this anti-environmental rule. And,
that's so important because right? I think people think of the law as being, you know, written in stone. It's, mm-hmm. it's done. Mm-hmm. It's set.
It's yes, you yes. know, or it was like a steamroller. You know, exactly. It was just coming and there was nothing you were going to do about it. And, you know, and I do think that when you do the historical analysis, it's a way to kind of reinsert some hope.
Mm.
Because you think, well, no, actually, like that didn't need to come out like that. And like
history could have unfolded differently.
It
could have,
yeah, absolutely, the serendipity of it, you know?
And it's not an idea of trying to go back to some sort of idealized time. I think we are where we are right now.
Exactly, but exactly.
To see that it's not predetermined.
It's not predetermined, absolutely. That's a great way to put it, that's absolutely. And then to sort of say, okay, so, and then moving forward is not predetermined either. Like, we can move forward in multiple different directions, exactly. You know? Even with things that we think of as sort of, you know, in a way kind of stale and tired and so, because I feel like Pearson a little bit before I kind of came along and got and found all this other stuff about it. It was a little bit like that. Like, it was sort of like, you know, it stands for this.
Mm.
A bright line rule. Great. It's efficient. Best rule. Let's move on. You know? And it's, and you sort of
just
think,
checkboxy.
Yeah.
You lose bit, all the
yeah.
Nuance.
Pretty checkboxy. Mm. And, you know, in the US especially, like, the casebooks are often accompanied by teaching manuals. And so in the teaching manuals, they're kind of telling instructors, like, this is sort of what you should be emphasizing to students. This is basically what you should be saying. And so that really shuts things down, and it just becomes, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like a meme, right?
Yeah.
It's lost. There is more to it. A meme in the, like, genetic sense, but also a meme in like, online. There is so much more to it, but it becomes this, like, rarefied single story that has
stuck.
Very little dimension to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's a very hopeful way to think that
sort of,
things are open. Yeah.
Things are open. You kind of sort of re-inject new life into it. And for me, I really feel like, you know, I mentioned at the outset that the animal interest was something that really took me quite a long time to even think about. You know, I was teaching in a colleague of mine, Lisa Austin. She invited me to come into her property section and teach more about Pearson, you know, when they were covering it just in the course. And there was a young woman in the audience, and she put her hand up and she said, you know, they were both going to kill the fox. Like, both of these rules, like, it's not like one of these rules is better than the other. They were both going to kill it.
And fox was probably, like, killed while this was already going on, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, dead. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Kirsten clubbed it, and, you know. And when she said that, it really made me think, yeah, you know what? There's a big piece of this here that I'm not including, and I really need to include. And then I happened to be at a conference for the Berkshire, it's called the Berkshire Conference for Women's History. It was held in Toronto a number of years ago. And there was a woman in the history department who I started talking to, who was also on the planning committee.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, I'm working on a book on pet keeping in England in the 19th century. And I was like, oh, get out. I'm working on fox hunting in 19th century America. And I was like, wow, we should really have lunch and we should, like, talk. And then we ended up making this group over at the Jackman Humanities Institute here at U of T, which is, like, it's an interdisciplinary group for people working on animal-related projects.
Oh, fantastic.
And that's sort of, like, where a lot of this thinking started for me, because we got together people, not necessarily animal rights people, but just anybody who was working on, you know, like, dressage horses or, you know,
thinking about animals
in poetry or in political science or philosophy or religious studies. We had people from all over, graduate students, faculty, and I started giving chapters of the book project to people to read. And then these kinds of comments were coming back to me, you know, that were more focused on the animal. And I thought, yeah, okay, I really gotta, you know,
well,
take this on.
Good for you for making yourself vulnerable in that way. And I think also opening, because I think that does happen sometimes in academia. We get focused in our own space with our own vocabulary.
Yes.
Even yesterday I was at a, you know, with a friend of mine. He gave a presentation. It was a fantastic presentation, but the language he was using was about caribou. But I found that the language he was using was just reducing them to some sort of, like, object, you know, and yet his data was showing that they've got these families that roam and make complicated decisions. And it led to a very fruitful conversation about how we talk and what the implications of that language are when we speak about animals, which is quite profound. Do you have any, so that feedback, did it come into just changing how you were writing about the case, or
It did. I mean, much of it was already written and preset.
Okay.
But I did, where I could, kind of augment a little bit.
Wonderful.
And then in the end, I ended up dedicating it to the fox. The book is to Reynard, because that's how he's referred to in the decision, Reynard.
So they named the fox?
The jovial, dissenting, joking judge, he calls him Reynard.
Did you give any history of foxes?
I did, and in fact, I learned quite a lot about fox hunting to write the book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, someone contacted me just a couple of days ago to ask if I wanted to participate in a book about fox hunting.
Oh, wow.
We're going to be looking at the ban in the UK and how the ban was upheld. There was a legal challenge to the ban, and it was upheld. And connecting it to the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story, The King of the Foxes. So I was like, I was so happy when I got invited to be part of this, because I'm like, oh, the literary aspect I'm totally into, and then this legal aspect, and we'll be talking, at times critically about fox hunting and so on. So that's great. So I feel like I think I did enough of that in there, mm-hmm. to kind of let people know, like, that, yeah, this is something I'm interested in.
Expand.
And yeah, exactly. We should sort of all be kind of thinking about it, and hopefully people will start teaching it and mentioning this, you know.
So you're going to read a quote from your book, right?
Yes, I thought I would. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is actually a part that comes
I love all the papers that you've got in your books.
Yeah, these are all my presentations. I know, like, when I've gone around talking,
you know,
about
an author's really thinking through their own work when there are scribbles in their book.
Scribbles on their own book.
You know, I think some people might write and they're like, I never want to see it again.
Yes. I don't have that feeling about it. It's strange. I don't know why.
Well, but it means you're onto something that you're finding perpetually enjoyable.
Yeah, I still really enjoy it, yeah. Okay, so this is a passage, and it's talking about the chapter in Moby Dick, Herman Melville's novel, chapter 89, which sets out the rules about fast fish, loose fish that I mentioned.
Moby Dick?
Yeah, so in Moby Dick, yeah. And basically the idea is, with the whale, if you're holding on fast to it, then it's yours, but if it gets loose, then it's free and open.
Mm-hmm.
But these rules purport to be very simple, but they're not really that simple, because you could put an iron in or a waif and mark it in some way. And so then, are you held fast to it, or are you loose? So it's sort of one of these, it's like a kind of classic Melville thing where he's like purporting to give you this simple way of resolving, you know, thinking about it, and then he immediately complicates it. And
okay.
You're like, I don't know, is it, I don't know if it's fast or loose, and I don't know, like, is it mine or isn't it, or whatever. And he actually calls these rules the two laws that contain the fundamentals of all human jurisprudence.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's sort of like a little claim. Yeah, a little, yeah. Okay, and I write here in this chapter, it rises to ask the following mighty questions relating to the conquest of America by way of a planted flag, and those who conquered it, the ancestors of his European descended readers in Melville's case. Okay, and this is Melville. What was America in 1492 but a loose fish in which Columbus struck the Spanish standard by way of waving it for his royal master and mistress? What is the great globe itself but a loose fish? And what are you, reader, but a loose fish and a fast fish too? And that's the end of the Melville quote. And I say, Melville is ultimately concerned in this chapter, as he is in most, to make a point about humanity. Namely, that we are all loose fish, i.e. free, and fast fish, i.e. colonized or owned in some sense. So the serfs, the slaves, the poor widows, the bankrupts, and even the archbishops and the dukes are fast fish, held so by their owners, their creditors, their fancy houses, annual incomes, and other property. Possession is not just half of the law, it is often the whole of the law.
Amazing. Wow. Wow, that's so good.
That makes sense in out of its context, but
you know, because you said Herman's bit there, and I was reading it going a completely different way, and then you unpacked it, I think, so beautifully. You know, I was thinking how he's saying, you know, what is America but, you know, a fast fish that's ready to be captured, and then I was like, that ties into what we've been talking about in terms of colonization,
you know, occupation. Yeah.
What is the world but a fast fish to be captured? That ties into what we've been saying about the environment and possession.
Yes.
And then your interpretation of unpacking that, you know, of seeing us all as not really, you know, you're raising that questions of freedom and what is free will really?
Yes, and are we really free? You know, we think we are, but we're also, you know, constrained in many ways, right?
Sure. But that's also not to then say that there aren't things where we have more or less agency, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So to not leave the impression that in any way here the you know, Pearson or Post were constrained in the same way as the fox was constrained.
Absolutely, right. Or that a whale would be in this case, right? Mm. Like, you know, and I think there is, you know, when people talk about animals and animals and the law, they often, they treat animals as very interchangeable with one another, you know, right? Like that a whale would be the same as a fox, would be the same as a rabbit, would be the same as a deer. And I just think, you know, I mean, you know, we go human as one category, and then we go non-human, and then everybody else is supposed to be in there, and it's,
well, even if we say human,
it's ridiculous, it gets really, right?
Problematized, you know, like in Canada, people say, like, what is a Canadian? You know, it's a it's a problematic, any sort of big category. Becomes a challenge.
Yes.
And I agree. So my research is looking at cows and the history of cows, and you start to realize the history of cows, you know, is very dynamic to the history of foxes or of whales, but even more so, you've got different pods of whales that have distinct histories. You've got, you know, North American foxes that have very different histories to foxes, you know, European foxes. You've got cows within the same country that have fundamentally different histories and lives right now, you know, at this point in time. So I think it's really just, and I think we are all constrained and we are all enabled through our relationships. Which is really, what a beautiful page. It opens up so many things to think about. So thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. I love the way you put it, constrained and enabled.
Exactly. Foucault has whittled his way into my brain, whether I like it or not. And maybe a bit of improv. Yes, and. We are yes, and. Anyway, thank you so much for giving me your time today.
Yes, absolutely. It was a pleasure.
A big thank you to Gordon Clark for doing the bed music, Jeremy John for the logo, and a huge thank you to Animals in Philosophy, Politics, Law, and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Herzenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IRoarPod.com.